You're listening to The Leonard LoPage Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The brutal gang rape of a 23-year-old female student on a moving bus in New Delhi in December and her subsequent death made much of the world aware for the first time of the problem the threat of sexual violence has become for women in India. Sampat Devi Pal, who grew up in a poor family in a small farming community in one of India's most crime-ridden states, saw the injustice being suffered by the women around her and decided to bring them together to fight back. The group she formed, the Pink Sari Gang, has used conventional methods of protest, including sit-ins and pickets, but members have also staged spitting protests and carry long sticks called lathi that they're ready to use if necessary. Sampat Devi Pal and her gang are the subject of Amana Fontanella Khan's book called The Pink Sari Revolution. It's published by W.W. Norton, and I'm very pleased that it brings Ms. Fontanella Khan to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
Sampat Devi Pal is an absolutely fascinating woman. How did you hear about her?
Well, I had a friend who was acting as an interpreter for her during a conference that she attended in Italy. And he came back sort of enthused after his meeting with her, just telling me that she was incredibly fascinating, that her gang was, you know, was an organization that I should look into. And at that time, I was a freelance journalist based in Mumbai. I was just actually starting off my career and sort of hunting for good stories, and this seemed like the perfect one.
And, she lives in a different part of India. Did you travel to meet her? You spent much time with her?
Yes. Yeah, so she lives in a state called Uttar Pradesh, which is in the north of the country. It's where the Taj Mahal is based.
But it's one of the most crime-ridden states in the country. Very poor?
That's right. I mean, even though it is the most populous state in the country, it has the same population as Brazil. You know, if it were an independent state, it would be one of the most populous countries in the world. But at the same time, it's the least developed in the country. It's crime ridden. The central government has described Uttar Pradesh as lawless and crime ridden. And so I would travel there from Mumbai, where I was based, and later Delhi, where I later lived, and lived with Sampat Pal at her house on two occasions. Over the course of 2 years, I would travel back and forth to this region.
Is violence against women worse there than in other parts of the country?
Yes, I would imagine it is. We don't have, you know, statistics on crimes against women are very patchy and unreliable. But the fact that it's so lawless, the fact that the state has very little presence there means that men, you know, don't risk any forms of recrimination.
And why is that? Don't the police go after criminals as they do everywhere else?
Unfortunately not. The Indian police is riddled with, corruption and criminality. And in fact, the Uttar Pradesh police, which is very proud of being the largest police force in the world under a single command, has been described by a high court judge in India as the world's largest criminal organization. You know, it's just so corrupt and so complicit in crime that citizens just don't feel that they can turn to the police for help.
Many people were surprised when a female photographer for an English language magazine was raped by five men in Mumbai just last month. Wasn't Mumbai thought to be a fairly safe place for women to walk around in?
That's right. I lived in Mumbai, and there's always this sense that Delhi was the sort of, you know, the rape capital of the country. It was, and that Mumbai was a sort of safe haven for women.
And Delhi is the capital?
Delhi is the capital. That's right. And Mumbai is the commercial capital. So that's where all the businesses are based. And it's also where Bollywood is based. So the film industry sort of is very liberal and has, you know, helped to sort of infuse a kind of liberal attitude in the city. But obviously, you know, that doesn't mean that violence against women doesn't happen in Mumbai.
Well, a suspect was arrested the day after the attack and what the New York Times described as an unusually rapid response. Can we take that as a sign that the Indian police have stepped up their efforts to stem sexual violence against women? Or is that something that might be just unique to Mumbai?
So I think that, the fact that the police responded so quickly in this case, I would say has to do with the fact that this was a sort of a journalist who was working for an English language magazine. She, you know, is kind of more privileged than your average, you know, sort of Indian woman. And in this very location where the journalist was raped, there's other rapes that have happened to less privileged women that didn't receive that sort of same level of attention. So, I mean, I don't think that we have much reason to be encouraged as of yet because of this response.
When you say privilege and less privilege, are we talking caste system here or something different in the new India?
Sure, we're talking about caste as well as just, you know, income differences. The gap between the have and the have-nots is enormous in India. And women who are from less privileged backgrounds are just more, they're more vulnerable to sexual attacks. You know, there's this idea that, you know, they're just fair game, I think, for a lot of, especially upper caste privileged men.
The gang rape on the bus in Delhi prompted weeks of protests, and India's parliament passed a bill in March that stiffened the penalties for rape and related crimes against women. Are Sampa Devi Pal and other Indian women that you've gotten to know optimistic that women will be safer as a result?
No, I mean, obviously, I think we're stepping in the right direction. The very fact that we're speaking about this in the first place, the fact that violence against women is sort of dominating the news agenda, the fact that journalists are reporting sort of a lot about rape against women is encouraging. But there's still so much that needs to be done. And the government did, they put together what was known as the Verma Committee. So this is a special committee that was called together to put forward specific proposals of what, you know, judicial and legal reforms that we push through as a response to the kind of crisis of violence against women. And that's been positive. I mean, there has been a few changes made, but, you know, it's not nearly enough.
And toward the end of your book, you note that rape is the fastest growing crime in India. Over the past 40 years, the number of reported rapes has increased by 792%. Do you have any idea what that increase is due to? Is it a rise in violence or is it just a willingness for women to report that they've been raped?
Mm-hmm. You know, it's obviously very... you know, it's a tricky business to kind of interpret these statistics, and especially when it comes to rape, sometimes an increase in rape cases is a positive thing because it means an increase in people, in women coming forward. But I think, you know, that the fact that more and more women are entering into the workforce, that are, you know, sort of entering into sort of public into the public domain has you know increased the sort of attacks that they're facing, and I think that you know that may account for the increase.
But don't all religions in India prohibit rape?
Well, I mean, what's interesting is that there's been several religious leaders who are revered in India who've made very controversial statements in response to the gang rape. So there's one sort of saint called Asiram Babu who's just this week or last week been accused of sexual misconduct himself, and he sort of inflamed the nation a few months back when he suggested that that the victim of the Delhi gang rape attack should have just sort of asked the attackers not to attack her and just sort of plead with them as brothers, you know, that if she would have said, "I'm your sister, don't attack me," that, and if she would have said a prayer, that this would have prevented the attack from happening. And so, you know, I think you get these sort of these very outdated views from a lot of these, you know, religious leaders.
Well, people can't be heartened by the fact that the 18-year-old who was 17 when he was one of the six involved in the New Delhi rape was sentenced on Saturday to just 3 years in a juvenile remand center. Many people see that as just a slap on the wrist.
That's right. And, you know, obviously it's with juveniles, you know, you can't kind of give them obviously the same kind of jail term as an adult. There's good reasons for that. But I think that the reason why there is sort of public outrage at this sort of short sentence is because there's a lot of anger and frustration with the judicial system. On the whole, the courts in India are seen as ineffective. There's a huge backlog that affecting sort of the justice system that, you know, that just means that people have lost faith in the system. And and the fact that it's take, you know, the fact that this short jail term has been passed just kind of, you know, it enrages those sort of sentiments.
My guess is Amina Fontanella Khan, her book Pink Sari Revolution, A Tale of Women and Power in India. Your subject here, Sampat, seemed to understand instinctively that the best way to get the police or government officials to uphold the law without paying bribes, and they, you often have to pay bribes just to get people to the police to investigate a crime, is to embarrass them. Hasn't creating embarrassing situations become one of the Pink Sari gang's greatest weapons?
That's right. I mean, I think, you know, while a lot of the time the media focuses on their sticks and the fact that they have kind of a very muscular, sort of aggressive image, actually they employ sort of very humorous, sort of tongue-in-cheek kind of protests that, as you say, just sort of humiliate the police. And I think these are very effective. On one occasion, the local police had accused Sampat of being a Naxalite, which is a kind of sort of a Maoist, a local Maoist militant group. And so Sampat staged this kind of prayer meeting in a temple where she brought together all the media and then publicly prayed for the sanity of the policeman who accused her of being a Naxalite. And everyone, you know, thought it was very funny. And it's just a good way of getting coverage. I think they understand. They're very media savvy and they understand that people appreciate a good joke.
And they're not just talking about rapes, as terrible as the rape situation is. India has a long tradition of arranged marriage. You've reported that there's been a long-standing practice of families marrying off their daughters very young, often before they're teenagers, and that leads to problems. There's the dowry problem as well. Wives are sometimes killed because they didn't come up with enough of a dowry to satisfy the groom's family. These are all things that the Sari gang is getting involved with.
Yes, that's right. I mean, the dowry system, to a large extent, is a root of many of the sort of the problems that women face. Because the dowry system effectively says a woman is a financial burden, is a burden to the in-laws, and they need to be financially compensated for this, and it's led to huge levels of dowry deaths. There's statistics just came out recently saying that a woman dies every hour due to a dowry related sort of crimes. So the Pink Gang is very They fight a lot on marriage and the right of women to choose their own partners. In fact, they officiate a lot of so-called love marriages, which are, are marriages between people who love each other, that, and they choose their couples, their sort of partners, independently of their families.
Their families actually prefer that they not get married or have forbidden them from getting married.
That's right, because in India, the overwhelming majority of marriages are arranged. And this is linked to the caste system, because the only way that you can sort of perpetuate the caste system is through regulating marriage. It's just by making sure that people only marry within not only their caste, but their subcaste. And love marriage threatens that. And that's why, communities often respond very violently to eloping couples, in very sort of extreme cases, even killing them in honor killings. So the Pink Gang has responded very forcefully to this. They officiate love marriages, and I've been to one. And, they proclaim these couples to be man and wife. And even though they aren't, they don't then issue the couples with sort of a marriage certificate. It still sends out a very positive message to the community that these are legitimate couples that deserve to be, you know, accepted and respected.
My guest is Amina Fontanella Khan, a contributor to Slate, The Daily Beast, New York Times, a Christian Science Monitor, formerly a contributing editor at Vogue India. Her book, Pink Sari Revolution, A Tale of Women and Power in India, published by Norton. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Amina Fontanella Khan. Her book, Pink Sari Revolution, A Tale of Women and Power in India, published by Dutton. Sampat, the main character in this book, was married when she was 12 years old to Muni Lalpal, who was 10 years her senior. You've written that she was allowed to move between her childhood home and her husband's parents' home until she reached sexual maturity. Is that typical?
Yes, at least in this part of the country, it is. When children get married off, a way to ease that transition is to allow for the girls to come back home regularly. After all, they're still very young, and so, you know, it's sort of less traumatic if they can go back and see their parents regularly.
But then when she reached puberty, she was expected to live full time with her husband.
That's right.
And her in-laws.
Yes.
How old was she when she had her first child?
She was 15.
And then she had five kids before she was 25 years old?
That's right.
How much formal education did she have before she was married?
None at all. I mean, Sampat, it's interesting. When she was growing up, all of the girls in the village were denied access to the schools. And so what she did is the school was like basically under a tree. It was out in the open and sort of cut off from the rest of the village by sort of bushes. So Sampat would creep up behind the bushes and sort of listen in to the lesson by stealth. And then what she would do after the boys were dismissed from class is that she would stalk them, and she would say, "Tell me everything that you've learned or I'll beat you up." You know, she would sort of literally just grab them by the shirt and force them to give her every single piece of information that they had. She was very, very, keen to learn. And everything that she has learned so far has been through, you know, sort of entirely through self-education.
How well is she able to read?
So I've seen her read sort of large Hindi words in a large font, and she'll do so very slowly, sort of spelling it out, sort of character by character, out loud. And she can also, you know, she can write her name, and she can write basic sort of bits of information. But on the whole, she's not literate. I mean, she's not comfortable at all with a written word.
Sampat realized early that she didn't want to live with her mother-in-law and convinced her husband to move out. Wasn't she especially upset that her mother-in-law criticized her for giving birth to girls rather than boys? Are people in India unaware that the father is the one who determines whether a child is a boy or a girl?
Yeah, they're definitely unaware of that. And I think it's particularly poignant that that women are perpetuating this kind of, this idea that girl children are not desirable. In fact, Sampat, she kind of came up with a song about this, which is, bemoaning the fact that women are married off as children. They are tormented by their mothers-in-law for years and years. And then when they become a mother-in-law, they kind of do the very same thing to their daughters-in-law. And this is something that happens sort of time and time again.
Well, how unusual was it for Sampat and Muni Lalpal to get an apartment of their own at the time? Is that something that is changing in India?
Well, it's very rare. I mean, especially in a sort of, rural context. Sampat, lived in a village where everyone lives with, all women live with their in-laws. It is unheard of to move out because it just means that you are, not anymore subject to control. It's a kind of independence that the villagers, and the community is not willing to grant. And so, it's unusual.
Well, her husband must be a bit unusual as well to allow her the freedom, all this freedom that is atypical. Did he approve of what she was doing, or did he simply understand that he wasn't strong enough to stop her?
No, I mean,
because she seems fearless.
She is. She's incredibly fearless, and I think he definitely tried when she was younger and when she was just starting out with social work. He tried to sort of hold her back, and they came into confrontations about it on several occasions. There was one incident in which Sampat was. She had gone to attend a village meeting where women's rights and human rights were being discussed, and Sampat had gone off there without letting her husband know. And when she returned, he greeted her with a stick, and like he started shouting at her and accusing her of being, a whore. He really sort of insulted her badly, and she came home that day and just you know, refused to cook for him, refused to talk to him, just kind of went on strike and just forced him to accept her, you know, her choices.
How did she get started doing the work that led to the creation of the Pink Sari Gang?
Well, it's really interesting. It was a long, long journey. It really started when she taught herself how to sew. So Sampat was basically the first woman in her village to, you know, to acquire this skill. And she then went and bought a sewing machine with some money that she'd saved, and taught herself how to use a sewing machine, and then gave sewing lessons to local local women, and also worked as a seamstress. So she had these like two sources of income. And she then, because this was very unusual for a woman to have this kind of, you know, sort of to be financially independent, to have her own employment, she was scouted, as it were, by a local NGO, a very, very small NGO that that saw that she had potential. So they approached her and invited her to kind of join their cause. And that's what she did. And so she then kind of, you know, became like a formal NGO worker. She also was working kind of, you know, in a school, even though she wasn't, you know, she's not fully literate, but she was doing that work. And then
Was learning organizational skills.
That's right. Yeah. And she was meeting with other activists and social workers. Up until that point, she was the only person she knew that had this sort of same passion for social justice. And then in her early 40s, just a few years before she started the Pink Gang, she was working on what are known as self-help groups. So in the early 2000s, the Indian government came up with this sort of program where if rural village women pooled together small amounts of money for like a long enough period, they would become eligible for government loans. And so Sampat was sort of organizing these groups, these self-lending groups. And eventually she was networking with a whole bunch of sort of women at a village level. And they started to come to her with problems that they were facing. They were unrelated to, you know, finances. And she started intervening, and she started telling them that, you know, the only way to address them is through collective action. And so they'd go to the police station together and like make demands. But they realized that the police would often shoo them away. They'd say to them, well, you know, who do you think you are? Like, you know, why do we have to listen to you? And that's when they understood that they needed a strong collective identity. And that's sort of how the idea of having a uniform sort of emerged out of that.
And they chose pink, and they all wear pink saris.
That's right.
She charges them when they become members because she's charging them for the pink sari?
Yeah. I mean, the membership fee covers the sari, and also, you know, part of it just goes to, you know, towards the organization.
And you write that the group started with 10 members, quickly grew. Any idea of how many members there are now?
So the most conservative estimates are 20,000. And, you know, it's they're spread over an area which is the size of Belgium. There's now sort of 12 districts in which they're located. Sampat actually has a kind of a hierarchical, almost like military-like structure. So she's the commander-in-chief of the organization. And then below her are district commanders who run sort of local operations.
Only women?
Yes, there's only women, although Sampat has a companion called Babuji, who is her confidant. They sort of live together most of the time, and he, you know, he's not a gang member, but he's definitely sort of, you know, plays a role in the organization.
Are we suggesting that she's has a relationship with him that's separate from her marriage? That would be really extraordinary in India, wouldn't it?
That's right. I mean, it's extraordinary in itself that Sampat is living apart from her husband. So she splits her time between her family home and this like other apartment that she owns, which is where it's her office is based in this building, and then she'll sleep there with this man, Babuji. And I mean, it's extraordinary. I mean, I've never encountered anyone who has this kind of a sort of a setup in India, let alone, you know, in rural India. But, you know, Sampat has a way of making exceptions to herself that are quite extraordinary.
Is she paid for her services?
No, she's not. I mean, she's actually, for a long time, she survived out of donations that were made to the Pink Gang. Also, in the early sort of period of the gang's existence. She was still working on kind of sewing. She was still giving sewing classes, so she was earning money that way. These days, she recently brought out an autobiography. So she makes money from that, and also just through donations from abroad.
As we mentioned earlier, the Pink Sari Gang helps women who've been victims of domestic or sexual assault, also victims of caste violence, arranged child marriages, government harassment or persecution. How does the group decide what cases to take on?
That's a really good question. So what struck me is that, when I first went to spend time with the Pink Gang, I was expecting it to be all action-packed, you know, lots of, like, confrontations and, like, lots of use of the stick and lots of shouting. And it really wasn't like that. They most of the time, they're sitting around and they're just getting information. They're sort of, at times, they almost operate like a detective agency. I mean, the amount of groundwork they do is phenomenal. They'll go and speak with every sort of member, concerned member of, incident, whether it's like domestic violence. They'll speak to the neighbors, they'll speak to the husband, the mother-in-law, the father-in-law, and just like, try to get a complete picture of what's going on. And only when they're completely convinced that this is genuine will they take it on.
And that's what you describe through much of your book, with a single case that Sampat got involved with in 2011, involving a 17-year-old girl named Shilu, who had been arrested and jailed after she was accused of stealing money and a gun from a legislative official. They did the kind of investigative work that the police should be expected to do.
That's right. Sampat reached out to Shilu's father. She happened to know someone in jail. Her son-in-law is actually in the jail where Shilu was kept. So she met with him and sort of got the gossip of what people in jail were saying. And that's how she learned that Shilu had been raped. It was through her son-in-law. It's extraordinary. Like the amount of groundwork she covered. Then she went to the village of Patara, where Shilu had been kidnapped by the legislature's men. She met with the local village head. Again, this is someone that Sampat knows. She got sort of that side of the story. And she only really went ahead with the case when she was convinced that it was genuine.
And she was able to persuade a lawyer to give Shilu free legal advice. And then the Pink Sari Gang staged a protest on the day Shilu was taken to court. Can you tell us some of the tactics that they applied?
Well, they kind of, on one occasion when on that day they had a sit-in, they sort of blocked the entire road near the court. All the sort of traffic was interrupted. It was a sort of very loud sort of protest. They stopped at a hospital where local doctors had kind of not given Shilu the sort of medical attention that she deserved. They acted very very dubiously, in fact, to the doctors, kind of tried to pressure her to sort of sign a declaration that the politician hadn't, in fact, sort of raped her. So they effectively stormed this hospital and intimidated the doctor there and gave her a good telling off.
And Shilu was released, but the legislator who allegedly raped her and imprisoned her was later arrested and jailed. Has he been brought to trial?
The trial is ongoing. It's with the Supreme Court right now, I think it's encouraging that he's even in jail, because I think it wouldn't have necessarily turned out that way hadn't the gang gotten involved. Because at the very beginning of the case, Shilu, the police didn't believe her. They didn't even register the case that she, about the rape. They had she was accused of theft and locked in jail, and the fact that the tables have turned, that Shilu is free and the legislators is locked up is very positive. But it's going to take probably some time before the verdict is.
Have politicians gotten involved? Has she come to the notice of the Gandhi family?
Yes, she has. It was quite quite sad because after Sheelu's release, several local parties sort of leaped onto her and sort of tried to co-opt her and bring her under their wings, just for a sort of, you know, very self-interested reasons. There was one politician who from the sort of opposition party who'd offered Sheelu a place in his house, which was very ironic given that, you know, Sheelu was raped by a politician in, you know, at his private home. And the Gandhi family took a lot of interest in this case.
In Sampat as well,
that's right. Rahul Gandhi, who, you know, is the son of Sonia Gandhi, the matriarch of the Gandhi dynasty, went to meet Sheelu personally. And, you know, part of the reason for that is because Uttar Pradesh is the most populous state in the country. So it's, you know, got the most seats in parliament. And, you know, the Congress Party is very keen to, you know, sort of reassert itself there.
Will Sampat go into politics? Will she ever run for office?
Well, she has run on two occasions. She ran for the first time back in 2007, just a year after the gang was formed. She actually ran against the mother of a local bandit. This part of India is known for sort of the banditry. It was plagued with banditry for a long time, and it happens that bandits will play sort of proxy candidates in sort of positions, and in this case it was the mother of a bandit, and Sampat ran against her just simply to send a strong message out that, you know, that people shouldn't vote for her out of fear. Then again in 2012 she ran for local assembly elections under the Congress Party, with a Congress Party ticket. She lost those elections, but she's vowed to run again. So I think it's very likely she will enter politics.
Amana Fontanella Khan's book is Pink Sari Revolution, A Tale of Women and Power in India. It is published by Norton. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.